Welcome to Oxford Plus, the podcast series that takes you deep into the myths and truths of the Oxford investing landscape. I'm your host, Susanna Diaga, and I've spent over 15 years in UK asset management. My guest today is Dave Norwood. Dave graduated from Keble College, Oxford, with a degree in modern history and went into investment banking. He has founded and been a director of numerous UK technology companies, including Oxford Nanopore, Proxy Imogen, Synergen, 4D Pharma, Index IT, Evolution Group, and Aura Capital. Dave is also the founder of IP Group PLC and Oxford Science Innovation, now Oxford Science Enterprises, the largest university venture fund globally, which has brought in over $1.5 billion of investment into Oxford since its inception in 2015. Dave is also a grandmaster in chess and has represented both England and Andorra internationally. Without Dave, much of the investment landscape of Oxford would not look how it does today. And so I'm looking forward to hearing his thoughts and predictions as to what will and should change over the next 10 years. Dave, thank you so much for joining today.
You're very welcome. It's nice to be here.
Wonderful. So going back a few years now, you set up OSI. I'd love to know what it was you identified that precipitated the need to set up OSI, Oxford Science Innovation, as it then was.
That's a good question. Sadly, we'd have to go back quite a few more years. I'm actually quite old, so it's probably better we start further back because it then will hopefully make more sense. It really goes back to when I arrived at Oxford a long, long time ago, 1988, and I read history. Everyone assumes I read chemistry, but I read history. Chemistry was too difficult for me.
I was surprised when I saw that. I'll be honest, I'm one of those people.
Yeah. I did sort of make friends with quite a few sort of scientists. And particularly with, I also have a background in chess, and most chess players are good at maths or science. So again, they don't tend to be historians. And I kind of kept in touch with these people after I'd left Oxford, and I sort of stumbled into the world of finance, right, really knowing what I was doing. I didn't really want to do it, if I'm honest. What interested me was going back to Oxford, seeing my friends who were going to do these research projects in various areas. And more, you know, we'd be in the pub and I'd be like, so what are you planning to do? Oh, I want to build this machine, or I've got this idea for a computer game. And I just loved to hear their stories. And then they'd be like, well, if only we could find £50,000, we could build a prototype. And so I'm like, well, you know what? And I've always been a reasonable salesman. So I sort of went and got some of the rich people I knew in finance to put some money into these early ideas in Oxford. Yeah. So it was a complete accident, and they didn't even go particularly well. But, you know, I remember one guy introducing me to his tutor. He said, my tutor can't believe you've raised this money. He really wants to meet you. So I met him, and he was a sort of very eminent professor.
Yeah.
And then he started telling me more and more stories and about ideas in Oxford that there were, and he invited me to a dinner, and it was actually a seminal moment in my life. I got invited to a dinner, and I'm going back now to probably about 1997. Mm-hmm. And it's a very odd story, actually, because a few days before, I actually got bitten by a snake.
That is not what I expected you to say.
Yeah, that's it.
So, what kind of snake?
Yeah, it was an adder. I'd been for lunch in the Ashdown Forest. We were a couple of friends, and we'd gone for a walk after lunch.
I mean, that's spectacularly unlucky.
Well, it wasn't unlucky, because I saw this adder, and I was fascinated by snakes.
Oh, right.
So I gently trod on its tail. Looking back, it was a silly thing to do. But I gently trod on its tail, and then started stroking its neck.
No, you didn't.
I did. And then it turned around and bit me. And it was pretty horrific, because the blood sort of spurted out. But I thought it was a grass snake anyway, so I wasn't particularly worried. It was only when my arm started to throb. Anyway, we went back to the hotel where we'd had the lunch, and I told them I'd bitten by one of their snakes in their garden. And the guy went paler than me, and they rang for an ambulance and rushed me to hospital. I literally nearly died because I had a terrible reaction.
Wow.
Spent almost a week in hospital. So I got out of hospital, and I had my arm in a sling. So this professor had actually invited me to a high table lunch at Queen's. And I was ringing him to say, I can't go. I've been bitten by a snake and I'm still not feeling very well. And I rung him and he was like, oh, I'm so pleased you rang. You're going to meet this professor who's brilliant. He's an amazing inventor. He'd love to meet you. And I didn't have the heart to say, well, actually, I'm not coming. So I thought, well, sorry, I'll just go. Right, how bad can it be?
Yeah.
It was usually like really enjoying myself. We had a lovely meal at high table, lots of nice wine and then port. And anyway, I was with my friend, who's Professor Pete Dobson, who actually built Bregbrook, really. It was his project. But he introduced me to this lovely old guy called Professor Alan Hill, who obviously noticed that my arm was in a sling. So I told him the story of the snake. And I thought, what's all this? I thought I'd have built some kind of immunity to being, I've been bitten by like lots of things like mosquitoes and stuff in my life. And he goes, no, it's the opposite. I learned, you must be a chemist, you know. So he then started telling me his story. And his story was unbelievably romantic and truly inspirational. And he told me about this idea he'd had years and years ago, that a way to sort of measure blood sugar levels. Yeah. And a bit of me like being nice. And so what's that useful for, you know? And he goes, well, it's funny you say that. At first, that was my thought. What is it useful for? He said, well, when it became useful is when we realized that with a sort of tiny prick of someone's finger, you know, you take a tiny amount of blood and you can see what the glucose level is, which actually became a product which has revolutionized diabetes. So if you know any diabetics, their lives have been transformed by the ability to self-test. And it all came from Professor Alan Hill's idea all those years ago. And I remember hearing about it. And I'm like, oh, that sounds interesting. Why don't we create a company out of it? And he said, well, actually, a very modest bloke. He said, well, would have loved to have done that, but we did create a company. We just sold it for $890 million. And I was like, wow. And he said, well, it's interesting, though, like, you know, no one in the UK was particularly interested. Mm. It was, as usual, a US company at the borders. And, you know, I'm like, oh, yeah. And I said, well, there's probably a lot of ideas like that in Oxford.
Yeah.
And he goes, you just wouldn't believe it. There are so many amazing ideas that could change the world, change people's lives, and even make money. But actually, he wasn't driven by the money. He was driven by the fact that literally, you know, hundreds of millions of people now around the world have had their lives improved by, and that in some ways was the beginning of sort of self-diagnostics, that, you know, what we all got used to during COVID. A lot of it can be traced back to Alan Hill and the chemistry department. So at least it gives you context of why I was really interested.
Yeah.
And I carried on doing, helping sort of spin outs from Oxford on an ad hoc basis until I found out that they were trying to build a new chemistry department. So this is on at the end of the 90s, and they'd raised a lot of money from charities, the Wellcome Trust, the government. Mm. But they were trying to build this brand new, they wanted to build like the most modern chemistry department in the world. Oxford Chemistry is ranked top in the world, and they thought, we need a building that just looks fantastic. But they were £20 million short. So they came to me and said, Dave, you're good at raising money. We've seen you raise money for these little companies. Why don't you raise us the £20 million to help us do the chemistry building? So this is 1999. And I said, well, what do I get in return? And they looked at me as if like, well, you know, nobody thought of that. I said, well, here's an idea. Why don't, in return for these £20 million, we would like to have a stake in all the ideas that come out of that department forever. Yeah. And they're like, well, forever's a very long time. That's not going to work. So we hammered out a long, interesting deal, which was basically we would share 50-50 with the university the stakes in the ideas that came out for the next 15 years. And we finally did the deal in 2000. I had to go and raise £20 million. And it meant Oxford were happy because they got to build the state-of-the-art chemistry department, which is still there on South Parks Road. And we then had 15 years to try and turn some of the ideas into something that works and hopefully recoup that £20 million.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of IP Group. That was how IP Group started. And it was a very unusual deal. It's the first deal of its kind. And over those 15 years, I've got to be honest, right? There was lots of times when I thought, my God, this is the most stupid deal. Why on earth have I done this? And I realized that if I just sort of sat there and waited for the ideas to come, they probably weren't going to come and I wasn't going to get my money back. So I sort of moved back to Oxford. And I literally spent every day, whether it was taking a scientist to the coffee shop or dragging them over to the pub to hear their ideas in the chemistry department, because I thought we've really got to work hard to make that stuff see the light of day. And conveniently, when that ended, the IP Group deal ended in 2015. By this time, I was long retired, right? My friends were still running IP Group. I'm sure you've met them. Mm. But I'd long retired. I was still in touch with them, but only for catching up over coffee or a glass of wine. Oxford was saying, we've noticed that in that 15 years, more ideas have come out of the chemistry department, pretty much all the other departments put together. Why was that? And I'm like, well, because we cared, we really had to try and make it work. So that was how the idea of Oxford Sciences came about. It wasn't my idea. It was really a continuation of an idea that we'd all sort of had all those years ago. Yeah. And Oxford said, you know what, why don't we try and do this experiment with every department? So yep. we partner with Oxford. So rather than IP Group, which obviously done deals with lots of universities, we just want our own private commercialization vehicle, which we called OSI. It's now called OSE or Oxford Science Enterprises.
Yeah.
And then we said, right, we're not going to go out and raise 20 million this time. We're going to be really ambitious. And in the end, well, in total, we've probably raised about $1 billion.
Yep.
And Oxford has got the biggest, in effect, dedicated fund or whatever you want to call it in the world. But again, with the same mission that goes back to that amazing dinner I had after I'd bitten by a snake, which is find brilliant scientists who've got ideas that can change the world and help them do it. Right. And so, in effect, lots has changed, but nothing has changed. That's really what we're trying to do.
Yeah, that's exceptionally clear, particularly the snake bite. So that completely resonates with what one still sees a lot of today. So my question to you would be, you know, we still see a lot of companies, arguably at the stage you're talking about, still being sold to the US. So we've got OSE and similar funds around the UK now that have emulated the same sort of structure, and they're functioning really well. And yet, it still seems to be the normal course, not without exception, Oxford Nanopore being an example, but that most companies ultimately end up needing to take US money or listing on the NASDAQ as a sort of default playbook. And so do you, with your experience, see anything additionally that we can do to change that as it's still evolving? And I'll ask a different question later rather than the witness.
It literally is the key question for me that I've wrestled with all of my life, what you've asked me, and I don't have the answers. I still think it's a great shame that the UK still does have incredible ideas, and yet we do not have the capital to allow the best of those ideas to go forward. And it's no use trying to pretend that we have. And I've met with prime ministers, I've met with different governments, every side of the political spectrum, and they all recognize that they've got to do something about it and say they're going to do something about it, but somehow something happens that it doesn't happen.
So, I don't know what you're talking about, Dave. I've never experienced this. Must be some other government.
Exactly. You know, they're all the same to me. Nothing ever happens, and it is kind of tragic. And I think because of that, there isn't this belief they can sort of break this glass ceiling.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of
self-fulfilling.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I would caution, though, like, I'm not of the mindset which is like, selling these companies to Americans or the Chinese or whatever is necessarily a bad thing, because what it does do is it recycles capital.
Yep.
It's a great learning experience. It's a great sort of role model for people to do, right, well, they sold for $500 million. We can do one better and sell for $1 billion. So it's not all bad. Yeah. And also when companies get bought, you know, you get your second generation entrepreneurs. I mean, one young lad.
Yeah.
One, I'm not going to name him to embarrass him. One young lad who came to work for me, you know, made $100 million from his spin out. And, so he has created a sort of role model here in Oxford for someone who can do that, right? You know, in my day, the only way you could become rich was to go into the city. So to me, I'm a historian, so I see things in a very different way. And these things don't necessarily move fast. You know, it's not a.
Yeah.
But yeah, the government still doesn't really do enough. We know that. And it will talk a good game. And if they are serious and we, you know, whatever we are post-Brexit, if we want to be an IP-based economy, we really have to do some urgent work, right? Yeah. And like you say, you know, UK pension funds, I've talked about it, I've sat on the patient capital review, and they're still not investing anything like the amount we need to see this stuff work. And if we don't make this stuff work, what has the UK got? You know, there's a bit like, it's nice to do this stuff because it's really important to do things like cancer. And we saw the impact of the COVID vaccine that came out of Oxford, which was amazing. I was so sort of proud to be involved in that in a small way. So, you know, these things are incredibly important. They're also the future of our economy.
Yeah.
And, you know,
and
even AI. I mean, you know, AI, we could have an amazing role in the AI world because Oxford is becoming a hub for AI ideas. And I worry that we're going to miss that opportunity too.
Mm. And in your interactions with government, when you've gone and sort of pleaded the case, what do you think the best intervention would be that they could do?
So I think there's actually two really important things. And to some extent, they're separate and to some extent, they're connected. So I've looked at lots of US companies, obviously. You know, people quote so many success stories in the US. What's interesting about a lot of them is that their first customers were actually government departments or some kind, like, you know. So this happens, and the Americans know how to build companies. That's one thing we can't deny they do well, right? But a lot of them get this amazing head start where if they're doing something really well, the government falls over itself to make sure that kind of, I won't call it soft money because they've got it, but it goes to them and they get their first customers so they can prove it works, they can get money and scale up, and it gives investors confidence. And actually, you know, just even in areas like genomics, where I've worked a lot, obviously, I was chairman of Oxford Nanopore in the other day, like, you know, the government come and see us and say, yeah, we really want to help, but could we get contracts out of them? So to me, you know, the NHS is this unbelievable resource, yeah. But how much does it really help UK startups? It just is impossible. So all this kind of value and where we could make a difference to help, we don't. And it's kind of weird. We'd almost rather give contracts to US companies than our own.
And by the way, that you don't have to spend money to do that.
Exactly.
I feel like that's an important memo to anyone in government listening.
Exactly.
This won't cost you money. This is a free solution.
This is absolutely bizarre. But it's almost like they're embarrassed to give it to their own.
Yeah.
Which is bizarre.
Like a bit of like benign nepotism would be a bad thing.
Well, the Americans have no qualms about it. And obviously now they're like, well, we won't even give anything to China or anywhere else. So like, so they have no qualms about backing their ideas, right? Because they believe in ideas. They see that ideas create the world, right? So it's like, so that frustrates me, right? Mm. So that, and maybe if people saw that the government was more behind that, it'd be easier, for instance, for pension funds to say, right, we're now going to commit 10%, say, to UK startups. Because we know, but you almost can't blame them at times saying, well, we're not going to commit money because they're never going to be given a chance by the government. You know, it becomes this vicious cycle that needs to be broken. So, you know, sorry, I feel I'm rambling a bit.
No, not at all. I think
in 30 years, I've created probably more spin-outs than anyone ever. And that sounds like a boast, and it's not, because most of them have gone wrong. Mm. But I would say, if at critical moments we could have accessed a contract, whether it's from even the Ministry of Defence or the would have been transformational.
And it's not a flat playing field. And that, you know, in my conversations, much shorter dated rather than yours with government, it was a bit bizarre that you almost had this conversation where they'd say, oh, well, you know, we think it's a private sector problem. And you'd say, but it's not. Sure. And the playing field isn't even, and Silicon Valley, lest we forget, was a defense project.
Exactly.
And basically still is. And the IRA, they're just pumping money into, you know, all of these spin-outs. And by the way, poaching some of ours because great tax breaks. And you do go to your point, if this is our plan, and we've, you know, kind of slightly ditched financial services, for want of a better expression, we do need to realize that we've got to fight for it. And that we're not just going to automatically be given a seat at the table.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
And to me, it's slightly heartbreaking because, like, that's all I've done with my life. And, you know, I'm not complaining. We've had some nice success stories and I'm not starving just yet. But I would have loved to have seen more impact.
Yeah.
But they all talk the talk. It doesn't matter if you're Labour or Conservative or whoever. They all say that this is what they want to see. And to be fair, there's been some good things like VCT and EIS and stuff. There's been, these things are really great. But
nothing moving the needle higher up the scale.
You got it.
Yeah.
So we can set these things up. But, you know, you then want to get to that scale of capital and it's just a desert.
Yeah. Okay. And so coming to that kind of spin, and we spoke earlier about, you know, companies further up the spectrum being bought out by Americans. But something that I've heard recently from a number of people I've interviewed and kind of beyond is this thing of, because that capital isn't domestic, it's encouraging a sort of VC playbook that is quite short term, that's flipping things, and that is actually, again, a self-fulfilling prophecy that means that the most ambitious companies don't get an opportunity to really flourish. And so if we want to build another Nanopore, to use an example you're familiar with and quite frankly everyone is familiar with, actually the capital loop that we're in is a dampening effect. And I'd be really interesting to get your thoughts on that. And if it can be sort of unpicked at all. I mean,
and it's actually got harder. I mean, like, because of geopolitical tensions.
Yeah.
I was just out in Hong Kong 2 weeks ago, seeing some old friends. And when I was last there, it was like 8 years ago before COVID, and raised a huge amount of money for Oxford out there. And now there's a feeling from them. They were lovely. They were delighted to see me and took me for some great dinners. But it's a bit like, well, you guys don't really want to deal with us anymore.
Yeah,
it's kind of like, so...
So we need more domestic capital for other reasons.
Yeah, it's a bit like, well, we can't deal with China. I got such grief for getting Huawei into Oxford Sciences. You know, I thought this was, one of the world's great big companies, and things are... we're all working well together, and then suddenly it's become a sort of political problem.
Yeah.
And it's all very well. Sure, we can ban China, we can ban Saudi Arabia, we can ban anyone, but then where's the money going to come? It's not making the life of the entrepreneurs on the ground any easier. The scientists and the entrepreneurs are like, we want to be really ambitious. Well, where are we going to get the money from, right? If we can't. Because the US are tricky. The US are very tricky, we know that. Trying to get their capital, they... do themselves, they like to invest in their own stuff, and they've done really well at it. So, they're interested in ideas to acquire at the right point, but it's usually so they can build their big companies bigger. We've seen Google do this lots of times with, the deep minds of the world, set up by one of my oldest friends, Demis. The expertise is here.
Yeah.
The expertise is in the UK. But, is the finance and the ambition? Because without the finance, it's all very well being ambitious, but if you've not got any, any petrol in the tank or whatever, you can't. And these are very long, hard journeys, right? They don't happen overnight.
Okay, and so coming to something that is changing, and, the Mansion House Compact has been signed by a number of key DC pensions, defined contribution pensions schemes, and many of the larger players in the insurance buyout space, and indeed lots of the consultants that advise those pension funds. And they are committing now to 5%, which I appreciate isn't 10%, and it's certainly not what the Canadians have in their pension plans at 20%. But 5% is still massive compared to where we are.
Absolutely.
I think it's below 1% now.
Yeah.
So there is going to be more pension capital by 2030. And obviously DC pension plans will be growing. So call it that it might be 50, 60 billion, could be more, that's going to be coming in. How do you see that impacting these problems? And what do you think are the kind of straight up positives? And what do you think are perhaps the bear traps that we need to look out for with that capital coming in?
Well, as you say, it's all about, if we look at what happens now, which is virtually nothing, it would be a quantum leap.
Yep.
So, like you say, it's not 20% like Canada, but it's still an enormous figure in the context of
a depressingly low one.
Exactly. But still, no, I mean, with those kinds of figures, we could create some amazing companies.
Yeah.
I think, again, I'll be a little bit controversial. We have to be careful and we've got to be honest. So IP Group went and did deals with all the universities, pretty much. It was one thing I probably had a dozen universities signed up before I retired. And it was great. We did Southampton, we did King's, we did Glasgow, and all of them have got great ideas. But even if we look at the US, right, the US has only really got two or three clusters.
Yeah.
That's a fight. And they're unbelievably good at it and unbelievably big. But even they can't support, there's only two really famous ones, and that's the Valley and the MIT cluster.
Mm.
And actually, I remember going to, I think it was Gordon Brown, Tony Blair. So I'm going back a while, right? And they were like, we saw this IP group idea. Could we do it with every single university in the UK? And I'm like, well, to be honest, no.
Mm.
And actually, I've probably done it with too many. I should have probably stuck to Cambridge, London cluster, and Oxford.
Yeah.
And of course, it was like, well, that's not going to play well. What about Manchester? I said, I love Manchester. I'm from Manchester, for God's sake. And, but you won't necessarily get the scale.
Mm.
And it's not just about they've got really good science. You can have a world-leading university. But if you've not got an ecosystem around it, it's difficult.
Yeah.
So, let's say the UK only produced clusters in London, Oxford, and Cambridge, that'd still be an amazing achievement that would transform the country.
Yeah.
But obviously they didn't want that. They were like, that's political suicide for us to be elitist. This is elitist. It's about creating the most powerful companies in the world with the best science in the world, run by the best people in the world. So there's no, it doesn't necessarily fit the sort of leveling up idea.
Yeah.
And that's my worry. If I'm brutally honest, right?
Yeah. Well, they've been conflated almost, haven't they? And they don't necessarily sit that comfortably in reality.
I think that's right.
And yeah. and one can see why, because you have universities geographically spread out. You have these great ideas. It's a tempting thing to say, therefore, hey, let's pump more money in and create jobs. And to some degree, it can be done, perhaps. But I had somebody called Mark Preston, and he is from the motorsports industry. And we were talking about the motorsports cluster. And one of the things that he really highlighted, which is pretty well understood, but it's very relevant to this conversation, is just the high labour mobility. And that if you move to Oxfordshire with your family from anywhere in the world as a brilliant motorsports, you know, F1, Formula E, either an entrepreneur or somebody joining one of the big teams, if that doesn't work out, there are lots of other jobs here. And that's the human talent reality, is that you don't want to move your family around willy-nilly, but moving them here for motorsports is easy.
Absolutely.
So then you need to work out, right, well, what's adjacent to that? What can we do that has that kind of translational experience where people can say, well, this actually isn't too far away, so I feel comfortable taking that job in Oxford too.
Spot on. And I've actually seen that happen. Like, even people who came with their families, like you say, they came from the US with their families, went into one job, it didn't work out, or the science didn't work, or the chemistry didn't work, or, and then within a few months, they were over the road at another startup. You know, I used to just go to Boston and hang out there for a few days and watch them. I'd go to the bars, I'd meet some of the entrepreneurs and just listen to them. I just listened. Because I'm like, you know what? I'm not clever, they're clever. What, you know? And one of the best things that someone said to me is, like, you know, you really need sort of three things to make an ecosystem work, three things. And I'm like, oh, interesting, I'm going to listen. And he said, the first, you need to have world-class science, tick, done. Secondly, it's got to be just a beautiful place, a nice place to live. And I'm like, oh, well, that's good, Oxford's got that. The third, you've got to be able to walk everywhere. And I was like, oh, I like that too. And that's how MIT sort of built that cluster. You see them, they, you know, a scientist is there. You can walk over for coffee with another engineer to give him a job interview. Then you can walk over and see a VC about raising $20 million to do whatever he wants to do. And that is the beauty of these ecosystems. You've got to sort of create, and once it starts to work, it becomes self-referencing and self-fulfilling. Yeah. But again, we're realistic, like, you know, can we create an ecosystem in all these university towns? Of course we can't. It's nonsense. Right. We know we can't.
So coming back to kind of that point around how you build a cluster and kind of cross-pollination between industry and universities, I'd love to get your thoughts on the Ellison Institute for Technology and how that's going to change the landscape here.
Fantastic. Just so exciting.
It is, isn't it?
It's just so exciting. And I think just having someone coming into the ecosystem like that and doing things a bit differently and shaking it up and is just amazing. I'm sort of so excited because, you know, here's someone who's created success on a scale that we can never imagine, and it's fantastic to have that. So I think that will, you know, and hopefully it will encourage more people who've won so big to think about doing stuff here. Like, people love Oxford. Oxford's got this weird... And if we could pull in some of that super talent, people have got so much more money that they don't need to worry about money or whatever, but actually just want to see ideas work.
Yeah.
So I think we need to be bold. I mean, like, areas like DNA sequencing, I've spent most of my life on that, and AI, again, I've spent most of my life observing that. You know, the UK could really sort of make a pitch to be world-leading in... What are probably the three big areas in the world today? I still think the sequencing of DNA, you know, is just everything. AI is clearly going to change everything we do, and quantum will speed all of that up as well. So you've got three areas that are converging, and, you know, Oxford could be a world leader in all three.
Yeah.
And people could start, like you say, with the Ellison Institute, you could start to see that sort of stuff. Oh, well, we want to be part of this, and not just part of it. We will bloody make it happen because we know how to make it happen. So giving some of these companies a bit of a rocket up their backsides, because some of them do need it. I mean, some of them are British as well, right? We can't just keep blaming politicians. That's boring, right? you know, everyone just moans or gives them more money. But, you know, I do think sometimes we're complacent. We don't try and grow our companies as aggressively.
That's definitely something I've heard before, just that ambition gap.
Yeah.
And it's a cliche, but it seems to be one for a reason.
I don't want to get into the politics of it all, but it's almost slightly traumatizing that, you know, Moderna delivered a vaccine and became worth, you know, $20 billion, and we delivered a vaccine and we didn't do anything out of it. It's a slightly, of course, it was great because we hopefully saved millions of lives and helped, particularly in the developing world, because it was cheaper and more easy to deliver. So it was great for humanity. But a bit of me would also like to see a sort of, a big unicorn win out of it, which is what...
Yeah, and reinvestment back into the university that housed it.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, that's it. You know, you start to see if this stuff works, it just goes back into funding research and inspires that new generation of scientists who can see, this lab was built by this success.
Yeah, and we're gonna, that, I think it's so cool.
And that's what I've spent my life trying to sort of encourage people to do. And at times you do feel, though, that we're still sluggish, right?
So coming back to kind of Oxford and the ecosystem here, which you referred to, you were talking about kind of going across the road and meeting VCs. And obviously, OSE is a big source of investment funding for lots of companies. And you also spoke earlier about being cross-department focused. Now that we are where we are and it's all still evolving and, you know, we've got this amazing source of capital, do you still think that being cross-department and, dare I say it, trying to do everything, which has a negative inference, I appreciate, is the best strategy? Or do you think that we need to see more emergent, kind of singularly focused funds coming into Oxford?
Yeah, good question. I think we need to almost go back to sort of some philosophy, right? I mean, that sounds a bit strange, but like...
I'll go with it.
Yeah, let me just give you a little anecdote. So in the early stages of COVID, one of my favourite pubs, probably my favourite pub in the world, the first pub I ever had a pint in Oxford when I arrived in 1988, was the Lamb and Flag.
Yeah.
And one of my old friends, she sent me this article in the BBC saying the Lamb and Flag had closed because of COVID. And I thought, oh my God, this is like the end of an era. Like, so many great evenings there where we had so much fun, but also so many serious evenings there. Like, you know, Nanopore, you know, we had no money in the early days. So we used to have our board meetings in the pub, you know, in the early days of Nanopore. And I just thought, this is just such a tragedy. We lose this pub. We lose so much of our history, obviously. It's got all the Tolkien and the C.S. Lewis connection, which is unbelievably important, you know. And I just remember thinking, I've got to do something about this. And what I started doing, I thought, why don't we sort of set it up as not for profit, something that's really about the community and about helping Oxford. And bless them, St. John's, I gave them the pitch, and I think they thought I was completely crazy. And I said, I really want you to reopen this pub, but allow us to do it differently. And we'll set it up as, we'll call it the Inklings, named after the Inklings. And we'll try and pull together some of the best scientists, the best writers, the best entrepreneurs, the best financiers. We'll pull everyone in. And anyway, long story short, we signed up more than 300 Inklings.
Yeah.
And St. John's allowed us to take over and we reopened the pub. And some of those 300 names, some of them are famous authors, but a lot of them are world-leading scientists, particularly from the chemistry department. And a lot of them are world-leading entrepreneurs who built big businesses. And no one was allowed to put in more than £10,000. And the minimum was only £1,000. So it was very democratic. No one could. But what almost broke my heart was some of the messages from people who were like, no, I learned my first chemistry in there. I learned everything in that pub. I learned more in there than in the labs. And one guy had built a business. I'm not going to embarrass him by saying who he is. The business was valued at $4 billion at the time. And he said, of course I want to be involved. I'm honored to be involved because it was such a big part of my research life, that pub. And he's gone on to build this amazing company.
Yeah.
And I just thought, you know what? It was doing this sort of process, I suddenly thought there's so much going on. There's so many people who have ideas and history. And actually, I just thought, you know what? If all we do is open this pub and some of them meet each other, we'll have actually done a massive service to the ecosystem. So,
well, you joke. I've had people say on this podcast, like, where do you go to meet entrepreneurs? You know, you bump into them on the street in the coffee shops in, you know, Silicon Valley or, you know, as you were saying, in Boston. And people have literally said, oh, you go to the Lamb and Flag.
Yeah. And it is, you know, it's incredible. I reckon I'm going to go.
We are not sponsored by the Lamb and Flag, by the way.
But I'll go there tonight and I'm certain I will bump into entrepreneurs, CEOs, whatever. So what is my dream? What I want to see, because I'm getting old, I'm 55, right? I would want to see some young person in the Lamb and Flag, a scientist who's got an idea that's going to change the world, and meeting someone who says, right, you know what? I saw my business 5-10 years ago, I've got $500 million in the bank. and I'm going to back you, and we're going to work together. I'll go chair, you go CEO, and but we won't sell out quickly to whoever comes along. You know, just and I'll help you avoid the mistakes that I made, and that's like the dream.
So sort of peer to peer,
exactly. And you know, and it clearly won't work like that. It sounds twee, but you know, just seeing things like that at Ellison Institute, you realise that that magic rubs off. It becomes part of the DNA of Oxford and part of the Oxford story, which for me is still incredibly romantic. There's been so many disappointments. It's taken too long, but I'm still a believer that some of the best ideas in the world are in Oxford, and at some point they will see the light of day. You know, First Light Fusion is a dream. If it works, it will be one of the most important companies ever, right, in the history of the world. No, you know, we'll see if it works. I desperately pray it does, but that's what you're playing for. And if you have enough shots on goal like that, so rather than these kind of slightly let's build it, finance it, sell it for 100, 200 million or whatever, I would love to see some dreaming again, you know, like some sort of, Oxford is about dreaming, that's the whole point, particularly if you're younger. But if you can have young people who are brilliant with dreams marrying up with older people with money and experience, we could do some serious damage. And I worry that we mustn't lose that. We've got to keep that magic.
That connectivity.
Exactly. And like I say, people in the world, what do people want to do? They want to have impact. So actually, even though funding is difficult, everything's difficult, if you've got a really good idea that it'll have positive impact on the world, the chances are someone out there will help you get there.
And do you think that, you know, ironically, the kind of deal that's in place with OSE that has this agreed IP for the ideas that come out, do you think that that has any dampening effect on those individuals thinking, oh, well, it's already spoken for? Obviously, the intention isn't that, but I've definitely heard people suggest things along that line.
It's a good question. Probably good to clarify this, because I've probably heard every side of the argument forever. So I know that I'm not anything to do with anything. I can sort of talk about it dispassionately. So, I mean, the way all the deals that were ever done, whether it was IP Group or OSI or OSE as it now is, had a simple philosophy that they only shared the university stake.
Yeah.
They never took anything off the scientists themselves. That was a whole philosophy. So theoretically, the scientists can never be any worse off. Because unfortunately, when we did this Oxford deal, some kind of lots of strange things sort of started to happen where people are like, well, the reason the UK is doing bad is because universities are taking too much equity, which is an interesting. And obviously, the scientists love that idea because it's like, well, the university should have no equity or maybe 5% and we'll get it all.
Well, I think the spin-out review has done quite a lot to break out that myth and the fact that Irene Tracy was one of the co-authors.
Exactly. But that was where it all kind of got conflated. You know, we get what we get. We just get half the university stake, for which we've committed a huge amount of capital. We didn't get given it because, you know, they got this massive stake and Oxford got 600 million for its projects, you know. Yeah. So to me, I am still slightly of the, at the end of the day, the university is a charity. Mm. And if you are an employee of the university and you come up with a brilliant idea, you should want the university to have a big stake.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the things that I did was to give my stake in OSI to the university, to my old college, because I thought, well, I don't want anyone thinking I'm here to try and make money and exploit these scientists. So I actually gave it. So it paid for towards the H.B. Allen Center.
Okay. Amazing.
And I actually really believe passionately that you've got to want to... The university, if you're there and a professor and you've had 20 years there, why wouldn't you want the university to do well out of it? It's going to pay for your labs, your students. So I think the debate got very charged and very emotional. Mm. And this, you know, we could talk about it for hours. But I think they probably arrived at a reasonable place. But I don't believe ever, sorry, just to finish, I'll have my rant here, this idea that, oh, well, that's why the UK is doing badly, because the universities gobble all the equity. That's just bollocks. I'm sorry.
I agree with you. And I think the spin-out review has been very helpful to sort of really open up what everyone's doing and compare it in broad daylight and, you know, kind of have the conversation in the open, such as we're doing here. It does, from conversations I'm having, and I'm not subject to it, but I don't think that people don't want the university to have it. I think that there has been a sense that somehow the signalling power of having the university is not somehow a positive thing. And I guess I would say that out loud, not because I necessarily agree with it. You know, part of the tagline of Oxford Plus is to kind of dispel some of the myths. Mm. And I would say this is a pretty well-propagated myth. Mm. And I think that it's quite important that we are sort of actively reaching out to people such as you've suggested, but also kind of, you know, institutions, entities, and make sure that Oxford has the right reputation as an investor, increasing the probability of success. And I don't, truthfully, really understand why that isn't the case.
It's an interesting one. So I can only speak from my experience. 2015, I kind of came back and I retired at when I turned 50, which was January 2019. So yeah. I sort of had 4 years. I think in that 4 years, you'd have to check the numbers, but I think I'm probably confident that in that 4 years, we created more spin-outs and raised more capital than in the last 20 years, yeah. just in 4 years.
Which is an extraordinary achievement.
So to me, everyone, look, Oxford, what I love about Oxford, right, you know, you've got 20,000 incredibly clever people all disagreeing all the time.
Yeah.
Right. So I just learned to live with that. But ultimately, numbers are numbers, right? Since Oxford Sciences arrived, the figures, any kind of matrix, anything you want to look at just went through the roof. Mm-hmm. You know, and funds came and invested in Oxford who'd never invested in Oxford, never even been to Oxford. Yeah. And I know that because I brought a lot of them here and they said, oh, we've never been here. This is beautiful. Maybe we'll hang out here more.
Yeah. You know?
So,
and that are they still coming?
They're still coming. But again, so I'm not here to do an advert for OSE, right? That's not, I left in 2019. I think, you know, it's still run by people who I'm very good friends with. I've got a drink with one of the senior people tonight. I think, you know, it's common knowledge. OSE had some management issues. I left and then they went through two CEOs and it all became a bit, you know, COVID hit. Yeah. So probably the personal thing wasn't there. I think some of the scientists like, oh, we don't see OSE anymore. I still can't get used to the name change as well. So you know, we don't see, whatever they call, we don't see them anymore. So I think there was a bit of, you know, oh, it's having a bit of a dark patch.
Yeah.
Not to say that it was on a great patch for me, Andrea. I'm not trying to make that point, but I think there was definitely some internal strife. I think, and I'm very hopeful they've got through that. And
yeah.
I hear good things again. I hear, oh, yeah, we saw them again last week and we're all yeah. working together.
So and actually, I've got Ed Bussey coming on next week and I'm really brilliant. Excited to hear what the plans are.
Yeah.
And very excited that, you know, there's a platform where hopefully further to this conversation, we'll be able to dispel in sort of real time and meet brilliant. Some of those, not criticisms, that's too strong, but like, you know.
Yeah, yeah, but we should know. We should, you know, it was an impediment.
Get up in front of it.
I've always said, like I say, that's why I gave away my shares at the start. So I was like, all I've ever wanted is to see brilliant ideas in Oxford get out there into the world.
Yeah.
So if there's anything stopping that, I want to know about it. It's
yeah.
like, it's, so to me, but you know, I've not heard
like anything, isn't it? You know, it takes years to win a good reputation and it can be a short period
exactly.
where, you know, you can lose it. And we spoke about this on the way over here to the studio, but I think it's incredibly easy to be a naysayer. And actually we need to be part of people saying, right, we can be more than the sum of our parts. We've got a lot of good stuff here. I love this, but pie makers and pie eaters, like yeah. everyone just wants the pie to be bigger because
exactly.
then everyone does better
exactly.
rather than worrying about, you know, everyone's little fiefdoms. And I think it's really important that Oxford and all of its stakeholders take some responsibility for being constructive.
I 100% agree. And Oxford has got this weird, like, I love the place, but it does have an amazing ability to be petty at times.
For
this,
yeah.
For this
I've seen it happen at a drinks party where I was like, you know that person's over there,
yeah.
right? Are you serious that yeah. you're saying this? And yeah. I was really shocked.
Yeah. So, you know, we've all just got to get stronger and bigger and get on with it. I don't live here anymore, so I miss the place. And the main reason I come back is to visit my pub. But, you know, there's nothing I want to see more in my life than these ideas work and Oxford yeah. become. Reach
it's so important, right?
It's you know, everything.
Again, on the way over, we were talking about cancer vaccines. You're talking about blood sugar testing. You know, these are things that change millions of lives, and we all want to see it happen.
Absolutely. And this place has got it. You know, what do we know? The world has got a lot of problems, and we also know that a lot of the solutions are in this beloved city of ours. So,
yeah.
you know, we've just got to have that ambition to say, right, we're going to go for it. And nothing's going to stop us.
So when are we going to host the big Oxford conference when we get everybody to come here?
You know what? Again, maybe it was COVID, but we need to do more of that.
Yeah.
You know, Oxford's got some of the nicest buildings in the world.
Yeah.
What they should be doing, and OSE should be helping them, and everyone, it's like fill those buildings, fill them with the best ideas in Oxford and the best people in the world. It's not complicated. That's what needs to get done. And that's what I did. I wore myself out doing it, you know, but I kind of, it's like, you know, we are going to have another conference. We're going to, we don't just want to talk about AI. We want to show everyone what we've got.
Yeah.
You know, and if we think we've got another Nanopore, it's like, here, this is what we've got. And we have to be ambitious. And, give them nice dinners at high table. It doesn't matter if you're one of the richest people
so
in the world.
It's so fabulous. It's such a treat.
Well, as we've seen with the Ellison Institute, people who are successful beyond anything we can imagine that will still want to be involved in these projects.
Yeah. They are hallowed halls, right? It's a privilege. It's a privilege to live here. It's a privilege to go into a college. It's a privilege to be around people that their ideas have the potential to change the world. And all the rest of us need to do is get on board and be helpful in whatever way we are capable.
It's funny you say it. It takes me back to days when I just arrived as an undergraduate, and probably I was a bit cocky in those days because I was a chess player.
Well, you don't know what you don't know yet.
Yeah, you just think you know, and like some people, oh, he's like a top chess player. Da, 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 da.
Yeah, I mean, you have more reason than most people.
Well, no, you know. And I remember, like, I think he was at the college stud. He was a good-looking guy. He was brilliant at sport and all that stuff. And he came up to, I think I wanted to join the squash team, and he let me play squash with him to give me a trial. He said, you might make it into the third team, you know. So it was like, and I just remember him sort of walking back at me and saying, yeah, you've got a chess. I said, yeah, I'm not bad. He said, what you need to understand about Oxford. He's like a year older than me. He wasn't my tutor, you know. He said, what you need to understand about Oxford is no matter how big you think you are, it's so much bigger than you. Yeah. Actually, it's not a bad point. You know, it's not a bad point.
No, I've said that to lots of people since I've moved here. Thank you, Dave. This has been a really great conversation. Is there anything else you want to add that you feel we haven't covered?
No, I suppose the only thing that, you know, lots of new ideas in therapeutics and vaccines, there's no question. We need to see the convergence of AI with some of our, you know, things like chemistry and drug libraries, because that will change everything. You know, the minute we start to use the power of generative AI to do research faster, it will be transformational, particularly when you sort of throw quantum computing into that. So you start to think, well, if there's ever been a time in human history, this is the historian in me sort of struggling to come out, I think we're going to see the equivalent of, you know, 100 industrial revolutions in the next 10 years.
Gosh.
Literally, that's what I believe, passionately. And that could, a big part of it could happen in Oxford. And it only needs one idea to work in Oxford. We've seen how big ideas are. That's what the Americans have taught us. You have one idea and it can be worth a couple of trillion.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd love to see people dreaming again. Like, the biggest ideas in the world, some of them are here. Why can't we have at least one that starts to have that ambition?
And just be ambitious.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Oxford Plus, presented by me, Susanna Diaga. If you want to stay up to date with all things Oxford Plus, please visit our website, oxfordplus.co.uk, and sign up to our newsletter so you never miss an update. Oxford Plus was made in partnership with Mish Kondorea and is produced and edited by Story 94.